Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
It's all right. I have a tea and a Soylent to get through this show.
Okay.
So even if this goes on for 45 days, I will have some sustenance. Probably not enough. My name is Eric. I'm here with Michael Kester.
Yep.
In Austin, Texas, I believe. Still in
Austin, Texas. Yeah. See, here in Austin, Texas, I'm rocking the high brew coffee, which is canned coffee that they make here in Austin, Texas.
Oh, that looks good. That looks tastier than either of these. Hey, this is double feature.
Hey,
I think we're supposed to say that. I'm sorry. I just forgot how to do the show for a split second. I don't know what the fuck happened there. I was going to say additional content is out.
Additional content is out.
Do you remember, year 7? Yeah. Well, we just fucking finished the additional content for that.
Oh,
here we are.
Yeah.
95 episodes into year 8. I don't know what happened there.
Right.
Just, somebody didn't add a 1. Or subtract.
Go figure. Yeah. Turns out we had an oversight. It won't be the first. It won't be the last.
Right. Right. All of the additional content now for year 7 are out. So hopefully you've heard those. And I think we have more people listening to additional content this year than ever, which is awesome.
Right.
Because I was actually starting to feel bad. I know the whole first year, it was a bit of a joke. Year 6 when we did it, because it was, you know, 20 people are listening to this. And then for year 7, we had more people, but the shows, we realized they're fucking awesome and in a totally different way than these shows.
Right.
And then I started feeling like crap. I was thinking, you know, here's all these great shows. Everyone should just hear these. And then when we did the Kickstarter, a bunch of people signed up for them. So that's really awesome. So now when we eventually get to the ones for year 8, there's going to be a couple month gap, I think.
Okay.
I'm looking at you so you can do the math and then tell me that -1 this year or +1 or something, and we don't fuck up again.
I'll do the math, but I'm not guaranteeing that there won't be another oversight.
We're not going to get out of the extra work though, because we have commentary tracks to record. So there's really no avoiding
that's
it.
That's right.
The speaking of the Kickstarter, we had a listener who backed it for one of the sponsorships we do.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't even want to mention their name. They wanted to talk about Phoenix Island and Devil's Pocket.
Okay.
These are two books. I believe they're out right now. I think we actually timed this super well to make up for the additional content timing. But you can get these on Amazon. And let's see, Devil's Pocket's released on August 4th. So, you know, look at the calendar and what have you. But go on Amazon. You can just pop these in and find them. So here's what the listener said. Said, the books are fun as hell, and they're the best, this is really interesting to me, best action combat writing I've encountered.
Huh.
Yeah, speaking from the perspective of the listener, I haven't read these yet. I don't actually know, I can't think of action combat writing.
No, I can't. I mean,
you don't really think of an action book. You know what I mean?
Man, although it's like all things, when you think of them and have no idea about them, all you can imagine is that they're the best thing ever.
Amazing, right? That sounds great.
That's the peak of something I'm not aware of. Somebody goes, have you heard of action combat books? And I go, no, but they're my favorite kind of books.
Well, and the listener also said that aside from the author being really great, he's a former boxer.
Huh.
So I don't know. All of this sounds fucking fascinating to me. We're going to do a journey. I wanted to blow through a couple things that don't matter really quick.
All right.
One, if you haven't seen The Hunt for Red October, the first movie, skip to the 24-minute-ish mark, and we'll be talking about Dr. No, the second movie.
Uh-huh.
The other mandatory thing to mention is that we have the year 1 remastered. It's on the iTunes store.
There we go. I was waiting for that. I knew that was coming.
So again, assuming that I haven't fucked up numbers,
uh-huh.
We were doing Chasing Amy and Dead or Alive. That was this time on year one.
Wow. Dead or Alive, not Dead Alive.
Right. So there's a really infamous thing that happened on that show that has never happened again.
That's true. Yeah.
And it's on Apple Music. So just go listen to it. It's the Chasing Amy or
DOA. Yeah, that's a thing we did.
Episode.
Probably a way we still feel.
Well, let's just navigate straight away from that and into, I don't know, a joke about a submarine, I guess.
Okay, yeah. So The Hunt for Red October is the first in our Jack Ryan half of this year's journey. Jack Ryan is a character written by Tom Clancy. Yes, that Tom Clancy, if you know Tom Clancy. If you don't know Tom Clancy, then a guy named Tom Clancy. He's a CIA agent. He's a specialist. He's an analyst. He's a hot shot.
The listeners already have a bet going on which one of us says Splinter Cell first. So I wanted to make sure I
definitely that'll be you because I was going Rainbow Six. So
Although you say that weird Rainbow Six, like there's multiple types of sixes and one is Rainbow.
Yeah.
The Six series, you know, one set in San Francisco, Rainbow Six.
Right. Actually, I believe one is set on your Facebook profile picture and that's called Rainbow Six.
Oh, there you go.
So Hunt for Red October, directed by John McTiernan, whom we briefly discussed a few weeks ago, and I thought we were going to get in hot water over because I mentioned that Joe Lynch was maybe comparable to John McTiernan. Turns out Joe Lynch totally cool with that comparison.
Yeah, right. Wrote you specifically to tell you that on the tweet space.
Right.
Now, I've heard him pitch that movie, Everly, we're talking about, as Die Hard in a Room with Selma Hayek.
Yeah. There we go.
Which is really all we needed to say on that. We could have done a Chasing Amy style episode.
Right. There we go. Yeah.
Can we talk about John McTiernan for a second?
Yeah, we can.
Because I don't know if we're going to get another big chance to do this.
We are, for sure.
Yeah?
Well, we definitely have Last Action Hero on the schedule this year.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, he did All in a Streak. He did Predator.
Yep.
Die Hard, and then Hunt for Red October.
Yeah.
If you want to give it the Everly treatment, you would call it, you know, Die Hard on a Submarine or whatever the fuck.
Right.
That's one of those things you search for on Twitter and then retweet 50 of.
Sure.
It's basically Die Antwoord the movie. But we were talking about, we were talking about Joe Lynch on that episode, and I had this kind of uncomfortability with pattern matching directors.
Right.
Where I kind of go... You know, I go, The Hunt for Red October is classical music. Die Hard is classical music. That must be a John McTiernan thing.
Right. Sure.
As pattern-seeking animals, we just look at two things, and then anything that happens to be the same between them, we go, that's the director's signature. When really, I mean, we're linking things the director might not even be fucking responsible for, you know?
Right.
He might always work with a producer that cuts out his original John Carpenter score and puts in a classical. I mean, that probably didn't happen, but you know what I mean?
Sure.
And you never know which things and you're just going to connect dots. So there are things in this movie that just seem so undeniably. When Baldwin's crawling around mocking Sean Connery's voice.
Yeah.
It's undeniably Die Hard.
Yeah. Very Die Hard.
I mean, he might as well be Bruce Willis.
Right.
Isn't that exact fucking scene in Die Hard? I don't know. It's a hard thing to wrap your head around. But when we see Last Action Hero, schedule spoiler, that I guess we'll know. The thing that I really wanted to talk to you about John McTiernan, and we'll make it short because I don't want to dwell on it, but it's crazy. Did you know he went to prison?
I didn't know that.
Like recently,
but it was alluded to for somebody on Twitter, not going to say who, Joe Lynch told me that he may have gotten in trouble for wiretapping.
Oh, yeah. I believe it was Ben Ecker
who baited Joe Lynch into admitting his knowledge on the scandal.
I totally forgot about that. That's right. That's right. So you did get a little.
Yeah.
You got a mini spoiler. You got like a teaser about John McTiernan's prison time. Yeah, he went to, this is so fucking funny. It gets even better. He goes to prison for wiretapping. You know who he's wiretapping? Is the producer of Rollerball.
Really?
No fucking kidding. For exactly the reasons you'd expect. That the producer of Rollerball was doing some fucking shenanigans. And he hired a private eye and, I don't know, wiretapped his phone or something to see what the what the fuck he was doing, because he wanted to change the tone of the movie or cut something out or whatever.
He didn't want to lose his hold on Rollerball.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's just, I don't want to make light of it because he actually went to prison. He's out now, but it must have been a fucking awful, that, you know, it just destroys your life. Mm-hmm. But it is so weird that it's the producer Rollerball. I don't know. I've been tapping Rob Zombie's phone for years, so I assume this is just how the system works.
So the one thing I want to talk about with The Hunt for Red October is that while I've seen maybe 20 parodies of movies like The Hunt for Red October, I don't know if I've ever actually seen a movie like The Hunt for Red October that was itself on purpose. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Movies with the green type text that come over the screen explaining what's going on.
Well, that's why I make the jokes about the Sam Fisher stuff. I mean, that the only time I can remember seeing that is fucking Splinter Cell. Well, and it's got the little sound of the, it's typing or computer sound, but nothing ever made that sound ever.
And it's just all these fake maps and
This
really, really bougie submarine with its fucking crystal chandelier periscopes and shit.
Right.
But, it's just, I mean,
nightclub lights.
Yeah. And everything about the way all these people are talking to each other, just the tone of the dialogues on these two submarines, even the Jack Ryan character has this really kind of hip, cool attitude that only gets parodied now. I mean, that guy is never in something on purpose. You know what I mean?
What a good character, though. I know.
We're
only one movie in, and I'm fucking loving this.
Yeah.
He's an analyst who writes books for the CIA who has to go do stuff on submarines now. I was going to say go punch people out on submarines, but I feel like the diehard comparison's also missing the greatest parts of the story. He doesn't have an action showdown except for the one scene at the end. Mm-hmm. It's not like I write books and we're not going to pay any attention to that, but I'm going to go kick ass on submarines all the time. He writes books and then uses his book writing type analyst skills to do 90% of the movie.
Right.
And then only has one showdown at the end.
And there's all these awesome scenes too, where, you know, Sean Connery's character, who should be the villain, who would be the villain in any other movie, would be the super mastermind villain, gets a few of these moments in where he goes, how did you know that it wasn't a real nuclear meltdown? And he goes, oh, I didn't, but I'm a good guesser.
Yeah, sure.
The fact that we are embarking on a journey who, again, one film in, involves a character who's just an adept guesser.
It's an analyst.
Educated guess. Yeah. Educated guessing.
Some analysis, perhaps.
And so.
So funny.
It's awesome to think that there's this guy whose number one skill, you know, a specific set of skills, and his skill is educated guesses.
I love Baldwin's character in this. I mean, we should talk a little bit about, we'll talk about Sean Connery in the next movie. I almost just fell right into making this the Sean Connery show, which I guess is part of the accident of this. Uh-huh. The show is spoilers. Did I do that? Who cares?
Yeah.
The big thing that spoils the fuck out of this movie is that Sean Connery isn't the bad guy.
Right.
And the only one who doesn't think he's the bad guy happens to be, you know, the lead character. So when you find that out, I mean, I still feel like I was on the fence about it.
Sure.
The movie cleverly did trick me because I'm going, well, if he's not the bad guy, who is? All of Russia?
It's funny because the bad guy in the movie is, weirdly enough, the Red October. It's this massive nuclear submarine that no matter who's piloting it is still massive nuclear submarine.
I didn't even think about it that way. But yeah, you're right. The Red October is, and it's called The Hunt for Red October. So the movie's title should tell you.
Right.
It's as if to say, hey, moron, obviously we're looking for Red October. That's the villain of the movie.
Because the only thing that can go wrong in any given time is surrounding the sub itself. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny at the end too, because the nebulous nature of the villainy in Hunt for Red October becomes utterly fucking hilarious when they get the crew off the sub and they're rescue boat.
Totally. Yeah. And they're cheering and
they're watching the movie that we thought we were going to watch.
Yeah.
Although it's, you know, the inverse,
right?
Because they're Russian, they're on Team Russia, and because we're American, we're on Team America. Fuck yeah.
There you are.
They're loving the fact that, oh, he drove them out of the water, and oh, he's fighting back, and oh, our captain is gonna, you know, save, he's gonna win the day for the Soviets.
Which is the position the audience was just in.
Right, exactly.
It's just such a good fucking movie. So it kind of leads you along. When we were talking about The Perfect Host, we stumbled upon this problem of you want a movie to surprise you, but then some people in an audience feel cheated. And how do you, you know, where is that balance? And so this is a movie that kind of strings you along. And then once it reveals the truth to you, it's basically that that Carney gag, man eating chicken.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And you go in and it's just a guy eating chicken. And you're like, everybody goes, I want my money back. And, you know, the guy on stage goes, hey, but now we're all in on this joke. So tell your friends to come see the man eating chicken.
Sure.
And then they don't feel ripped off. That's exactly what the movie's doing.
Right.
It's going, but look at the Russians on the sub. Now we can all laugh at them together.
Well, and two, the thing that's hilarious is the typical villainy for a spy action thriller, akin to, but not exactly like Hunt for Red October, has the sidekick to the supervillain as kind of this, usually in these movies, he's the super evil one. I'm thinking of The Rock, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Where the main villain's side guy is like, why don't we just kill everybody, Captain? And the captain's like, no, let's not just kill everybody.
Sure.
There's got to be some semblance of patriotism here outside of just killing people at random.
Right.
And in this movie, the right-hand man is the most sympathetic character in the history of spy thriller cinema.
Oh, I know.
And as if it wasn't any worse, watching Sam Neill die and say, and you know he's going to say it too. He gets shot and you go, oh, please don't mention Montana. Please don't mention Montana.
Right, he's like sappily hurtful.
Yeah.
You just have to, I mean, yeah, I know that's coming and I'm kind of ready to roll my eyes, but at the same time I go, that is really sad. Now we're just getting Sean Connery's character off the sub.
Right. You know what makes up for it is the fact that he's so naive when he's asking questions. And he goes, you don't need papers to cross state borders.
Oh, God, it's so good.
And you go, oh, he's never been free before.
Yeah.
I'm glad I'm an American. It's those very, you know, American Tom Clancy, our nation is the best nation moment.
He's going to buy an RV and eat rabbits. That's his dream.
Yeah.
It's, you know, in one of those perhaps, but not definitely John McTiernan type scenes where characters get more heart than, you know, than they need.
Right.
Which is just another one of those things. It's just one scene, right? I mean, a lot of directors might do this and it always gets cut for time. And just in these particular movies, it doesn't. Maybe his scenes have twice as much heart and it all gets cut out for time.
Right.
No one has any idea. Or I should say, I don't know. Maybe everybody else knows.
Right.
So that's Sam Neill.
Right.
And then we covered Alec Baldwin and we covered Sean Connery.
Mm-hmm.
James Earl Jones is in this movie.
James Earl Jones shows up. Yeah.
Tim Curry.
Yep.
Jeffrey Jones. Letting you know it is 1990.
Right.
I believe that's what that accomplishes. Stellan Skarsgård, who is...
which is weird.
In the Avengers now.
Just, yeah, exactly.
And then fucking Scott Glenn, who is the guy...
Oh, Scott Glenn.
In Sucker Punch. The guy in Sucker Punch.
He's in a few other things too, but most famously on DF, Sucker Punch.
Right. Well, because we don't cover the Daredevil TV show.
Right. And we haven't covered Tall Tale.
Sure. Wasn't he in Silence of the Lambs too?
Yeah, he's in Silence of the Lambs.
Scott Glenn. Oh man. So the cast in that fucking Tim Curry. Hold on. Did we just go right over that? I just can't. I'm so not used to seeing Tim Curry. I wonder what he does just for a job. What he's not in enough movies that he's acting like every fucking month of his life. I feel like I've only seen Tim Curry. He's like a groundhog or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The ones I think of off the top of my head are very quickly It and Rocky Horror. Not in that order.
Not Home Alone 2?
No, not Home Alone 2. But
okay.
I mean, every single role he plays.
Muppet Treasure Island. Yeah. Clue.
They're all over the place. It's crazy. I love Tim Curry. What a weird fucking spot to see him.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't make a joke about it earlier, but you had mentioned the language.
Yeah.
And this is such an infamous movie for this technique.
Right.
Which I feel like it's been used a couple places, but you have a lot of, you have to have a lot of balls to do this, to basically just go the way they zoom in on the mouth and that in the middle of reading a quote, and then it switches to English and you're just supposed to know that, okay, now they're not really speaking English, but here
we're just understanding Russian.
Here, audience, we'll make this easier for you.
Yeah.
And
it's a Rosetta Stone moment.
This should have set some kind of precedent where all movies could do this. And yet I feel like films still look at this and go, well, I don't know if we can get away. I mean, Hunt for Red October got away with it, but I don't know if we could do that now.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if you can, if anybody can make a successful film where Sean Connery in his thick Scottish accent speaks English and he's the leader of a Russian nuclear sub, you can get away with anything. I mean, so there's that new movie, The Tribe, which has done the exact opposite of this.
I don't know about this.
Where it's sign language, but there's no subtitles.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. At least I understand. I haven't gotten around to it, but that's everything I read is about how the director's no subtitles, none.
Welcome to Michael Kester makes up movies that probably don't even really exist.
Probably not.
You know, the thing this does that everybody looks at is it makes it easier. Oh, easier for the audience. We don't have to deal with the subtitles and blah, blah, blah. But I think what's often overlooked is that it does this other thing. It allows the audience, or an English speaking audience, to more easily identify with the Russians.
Sure.
Imagine if you had to read subtitles every time these characters came up. I feel like, unfairly, but I feel like I'm going to go, that's the outsiders. You know, that's not my group. That's not my tribe.
Sure.
Those are other.
Sure, it's just like in Game of Thrones. It's the same basic principle.
Yeah.
The barbaric anybody who doesn't speak English in Game of Thrones is not even a candidate.
Well,
you know what I'm talking about?
So yeah, right. Because we're not going to convince everybody to start. I don't want to go to a big fucking Game of Thrones thing. But actually, since you mentioned the fantasy realm.
Yeah.
You know, we see this in sci-fi movies all the time where, I mean, look at Star Wars.
It's Klingons.
A quick Klingons. Go-to for that.
Star Trek.
But Star Trek's a little bit different. I think they give it more consideration.
Sure.
In Star Wars, you never see English text.
That's true.
But everyone speaks English.
That's true.
And maybe they don't, maybe Star Wars was a bad example because somebody actually knows this. It's written canonically somewhere. But in a lot of movies that take place in other galaxies, they don't speak English, but we're going to make the movie in English because we don't want to make up a whole fucking language that no one on Earth can understand.
Right.
And then subtitle.
Unlike Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Right. Well, maybe sometimes the joy's there.
So really quick, before we switch to the next movie, and this is just a warning. If you've skipped to this point, this is a massive spoiler.
Careful what you shoot at in here.
So we talked a little bit about how much unnecessary affection Sam Neill's character gets. And I feel like this movie also betrays that dynamic by going, we don't need to explain the villain, just show him looking menacing early and then make him bad later.
Yeah. Blame the cook.
Yeah.
We should start a precedent here.
Yep.
Hey, menacing and stuff, Dr. No.
So the thing about Dr. No for me is I'm not nearly as submerged in the Bondiverse as you are.
You're going to use submerged on the submarine show?
Well, we're on Dr. No now. It's a different thing. You've seen all of them. You've seen all of them.
I have, probably.
I don't imagine you've seen Spectre.
No, I haven't.
Which is interesting because that actually gets brought up in this movie, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's out now, isn't it? Oh, man. Now I do.
No, it's not out yet.
It's not out. Okay.
I don't think it's out yet.
We're two people on the internet talking about James Bond. Don't know if Spectre's out. That's the podcast you're listening to right now. Spectre is one of my favorite things about the whole Bond universe. So we should get to that a little bit, but sorry, okay, go on.
So it happens more than this movie.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Sorry. My thing about this movie is that I've seen, let's see if I can just ballpark. Well, no, that's easy. I've seen Dr. No. I've seen the Roger Moore one with Christopher Walken as the villain. And then I've seen all the Pierce Brosnans and all the Daniel Craigs. That's what I've seen James Bond wise. So arguably no James Bond movies is what I've seen.
And you were the one who picked these out.
Yeah.
We may have to.
Well, I want to learn. Yeah, I want to learn.
I
know.
But I was sort of assuming we both had the same Bond knowledge.
Hell no.
So I went, Michael, you picked the Bond ones. I don't know. You know the Jack Ryan stuff. You know the Bond. I didn't know that. We might be adjusting those because we just sort of went, these look good. Quick, get the schedule out.
So the thing about Dr. No for me is that as the first Bond movie, I don't feel like it sets very many precedents for what has become the caricature of James Bond. Mm-hmm. Namely things like gadgets and the MI6.
Yeah.
However, one of the things that I think that this movie sets a greater precedent for than Bond ever achieves another time is fucking stuff.
Well, you would be wrong about that, surprisingly.
Okay.
Wait till you get into the 70s. That's when all the fucking happens.
I love in this movie, just calling the scene out when James goes to the mountain cabin.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
After he successfully has not run off the road.
Mm. And in one of those scenes that doesn't show up in movies anymore.
Right.
You remember those scenes where a car would drive off the road and then you would have the shot where it drives down a mountain and then blows up at the bottom?
Right, right.
Where did that scene go?
I don't know.
That used to be in every car chase. When did that stop happening? Double feature show at iCloud.com.
And then he gets there and she's all, I didn't expect you to be here this soon. And obviously James Bond gets the picture. And so he's like, whatever, I'm just going to fuck this bitch and then call the police. That's
should I pull out? I'm sorry. I was confused.
I just think that scene for me feels the most James Bond.
Yeah.
The most. And again, I don't have as much James Bond knowledge, but to me that feels the most, you know, he's smart. He's ahead of the game. He's in it for the poontang. And then after he's used the person he needs to use, that whatever, fuck him. I'm James fucking Bond.
Peace out. Right.
That and of course Mystery Island with Fire Dragon. That, I guess, lands somewhere in James Bond.
This is actually the only Bond movie with a dragon. Now, again, I haven't seen the new one, but I assume there is no...
Christoph Waltz is in Spectre.
Pretty sure there's no dragon in any of the other movies. The Bond movies and their relationship to women is all over the place. Generally, there is an idea of James Bond that is distasteful towards women. There's been a lot of... Actually, there's been entire books that are written, I want to say in the opposite direction, but the one I'm thinking of in particular kind of covers everything. It's not really important. But over time, just as cinema has a reaction to what is acceptable for really any minority, not just women, things change. We start to have these, especially in the more recent films, everything kind of around the Halle Berry era is, look at the powerful female figures in the James Bond movies.
Right. But still the figures, still look at their figures.
Well, that never changed. You never get like, there's nothing I could say here that wouldn't be insulting. I was going to try to find.
You're going to try to name. Name a female actor who did not have an attractive figure.
I know, that's exactly what I just attempted to do.
However, you saw better than doing that, and so
I backed the fuck away.
You get
away.
All the brownie points.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say you never have a 90-year-old Sean Connery playing the Bond girl.
Right there, but you go. Nice. I don't.
Yeah. See, that's fine. Nobody minds that.
Although Alzheimer's, so ouch. Too soon.
Damn it. Watch Sean Connery die before this episode comes out. I'm just all sorts of fucked. That's going to actually happen now. I won't edit this out if it does.
Yeah, I could totally.
Fucking awful timing. No, I think that, you know, when I even think about the phrase Bond girl, there's something about it. in today's cinema that just seems a little repulsive, like a little scummy. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It's definitely going to get more scummy before it gets less scummy. So prepare for that. I don't know if those will be in our particular movies, but there's an era for it.
I definitely think that one of the biggest conversations about James Bond versus Jack Ryan is the Bond girl. Aside from the patriotism, the loyalty to your nation.
Oh, it's also different countries. Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, pat ourselves on the back.
I think that James Bond and Jack Ryan together are going to be interesting because I know that there are different climates of loyalty to the James Bond movies, just from what I've seen. And in this movie, it feels way less for England, James.
Yeah.
Than, you know, GoldenEye. But
well, yeah, that goes up and down too, actually, in the movies. Some it's, you know, James Bond's completely rogue and that's the point of the film.
Right, right.
Where others are more patriotic, I suppose.
But I think that the idea of the Bond girl and the fact that the Bond girl has become this cinematic faux pas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a thing in spy cinema.
Sure.
It's the evolution of femme fatale, right?
Mm-hmm.
Once you had exploding pens, your femme fatales become Bond girls. That's kind of the cinematic evolution.
Yeah.
And the difference being that Bond girls rarely get the upper hand because James Bond always wins.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about James Bond and not talk about the female tropes around it. I mean, it seems like the only way to be super tasteful about it is just to ignore it, but it's such a heavy part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Spy movies in general are one of the few kind of subgenres I can think of that never really evolved past the mold of, you know, solo male protagonist.
Jessica Rabbit.
You know what I mean?
Sure, totally.
Imagine, totally.
Although there is that new movie Spy with
Melissa McCarthy.
Melissa McCarthy.
I don't know if that's, I mean, I guess that counts, right?
Mind you, this is the second time I've used a Melissa McCarthy film to debunk your claim that something doesn't happen.
What was the other one?
Buddy cop movie.
Oh, damn it. This is the year of Melissa McCarthy being my foil. Yeah, she just proves everybody wrong, I guess. Maybe that's the beginning of it. I don't know. I want to discredit it because, comedy. But I also heard that movie was fucking terrific. So I don't know. I just don't know anything about it. Or James Bond, for that matter. So we're really right in about the same place.
So specifically with Dr. No, another thing that... so this is going to be a really good way to go through this because you've seen all these movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of just shooting in the dark. So one of the other things that I really like about Dr. No, the character, is that he has an underground lair with fucking fish walls and metal hands. I mean, one of the things that I look for going into a James Bond movie is kind of the opposite of what we get with these Marvel movies or any superhero movie. I don't want to pick on Marvel and I'm not picking on them, but the idea that you have this hero with such and such and so abilities. And then this villain who has idiosyncratic abilities that slightly may foil the hero's abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore you have an interesting and even fight. What I like about James Bond is that it always seems like you have this guy who's basically armed with a rock hard cock and his mind up against somebody who's slightly superhuman.
Oh, don't forget that wet hair he puts on the closet. That's the gadget in this film, I guess.
Yeah, there are no other gadgets. But I just
that's James Bond, world's greatest detective, I think is what that scene is. Little Batman.
I like that Dr. No has metal hands and that he has like this super lair and that he's doing crazy scientist shit.
Yeah.
And James Bond is like, all right. I mean, I'm just gonna spy you out.
The way that they portray Dr. No in here, he becomes,
aside from being terribly racist,
well, Dr. No, so there's a weird thing that happens,
is half German, is that what you're about to tell me? Because that's still not okay.
No, I wasn't going to defend that at all. And also, you want to talk about mixed ethnicity,
No.
Yes, you do. Honey Rider.
Yeah.
Is a composite of like three women.
Uh huh.
So there's the actress who plays her.
Uh huh.
There's, well, her singing voice, I hear both things. I think when she's doing the song, it's different on the soundtrack. She has another voice on the soundtrack. But the woman who does her voice in this is Nikki Vanderzil. So they basically just overdubbed all of her. It's all ADR. Her entire voice performance.
Yeah.
I actually think Nikki did voices for almost all the women in the film. So I don't know if that was a result of where they were shooting and accents, or if they just ADR'd the whole movie because it was the 60s and I don't know, sound was new. I don't know where I'm going with this. But Dr. No, they kind of bring him back. And this is where people who geek out on Bond are going to fucking flip out on me, but they're all wrong.
Okay.
There's two ways you can kind of approach the Bond movie. So we might as well set the groundwork here now.
Mm-hmm.
People do geek out on Bond. Bond is very trivia heavy. You know, there's 23 fucking movies. People know all the watches and the cars and all of that stuff. And that is one way to cover it, to geek out so much that you're part of that elite club. But the other way to cover it is to go, these films are accessible, just watch them and come at them and see what you notice, which is our approach for everything. So I don't know why it'd be any different here.
Right.
The Bond movies are also kind of the origins of Pet the White Cat. I know it isn't for our show, but when you think of the Dr. Evil Pet the White Cat,
yeah,
that's modeled after a Bond villain. Surprisingly, not Dr. No.
Right. Super surprisingly.
Blofeld is the name of the villain who shows up in later Bond movies and is one of the few things that ties a lot of the movies together.
Okay.
Besides the staple characters, is just every once in a while you find out that the guy behind it is Blofeld. And he, you know, he's got a big, he's basically Dr. No with a big scar over one eye and a little white cat that he pets in a big evil chair.
Okay.
And it's so weird to see him next to Dr. No, because clearly when they got to Blofeld, they were like, oh, why'd you waste the Japanese turtleneck suit thing on that mad scientist guy? We were going to use that for the actual super Bond villain, and they just did it again. So I feel like Dr. No started to set a lot of the groundwork for who is actually one of my favorite characters from this franchise. He's kind of he's the first draft of this Blofeld character. And Blofeld is, you know, number one at Spectre.
Okay.
Which is this organization that is, you know, nefarious in nature and always fucking behind everything.
Uh-huh.
And so kind of looking at those two characters, and I wanted to talk about them a little bit here because I don't know that we're going to hit any of the movies Blofeld's actually in, which is a little bit of a bummer, but also there's 23 of them.
I know for a fact that two of them won't have Blofeld. Yeah.
Right. I don't think any of, well, yeah, right. The ones you've seen.
Yeah.
Good job. Yeah. I mean, he's not, I don't want to make it out like he's in 10 of them. He's, you know, mainly the villain in one and shows up in a lot of different places. But Dr. No really is solid in that mad science kind of, I don't want to say caricature, that sounds wrong, but you know what I mean. He's a mad scientist, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's got a little bit, it's mad scientist and Napoleon. You kind of mash those two things together. And it's a funny character to be the antithesis of this, of everything James Bond stands for, really the villain of the movie, because you only hang out with him for the last 30 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
It's called Dr. No. There's no Dr. No until the end of the movie.
Right. Well, and they don't even really talk too much about him until then.
No.
They mention him early enough for you to go, oh, that's the name of the movie.
Yeah, right, but right.
You don't really get to see Dr. No face to face until the, you know, table with the fish behind him.
That's one of the things that I do want to credit the Bond movies for. Is the villains that become iconic. There's not a Bond movie that I can readily recall that features the villain too much. It would be really interesting. Again, we'll call on our double feature resident data scientist for this. How much screen time each villain gets in each Bond movie? Because I always feel like it's relatively small.
Mm-hmm.
We don't spend time hanging out and dwelling there and getting sick. It's always less is more. It's always leave the audience wanting more and having an iconic picture of what that villain is. We don't want to watch Dr. No sitting around in his palace, just doing nothing.
Crushing shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eating stuff and watching fish. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It's just until it's relevant to the story.
Right.
We don't see him. And so it builds up and there's anticipation.
Sure.
And also what that means is there's these side characters,
mm-hmm.
which is something that it didn't really strike me until just now is a bizarre thing where we have all these people trying to take out James Bond that aren't Dr. No, and we just dispatch them left and right. Some movies have several Bond girls.
Right.
There's just characters that it's like mini-sodes.
Mm-hmm.
We go in and we do a 20-minute adventure here, and then we throw somebody off the trail and we have sex with this chick, and then we go do that again somewhere right. else, and then right. we go to the villain.
Right.
Which is kind of a bizarre formula, but it lets James Bond seem more like he's a world traveler.
Mm-hmm.
He's an adventurer. He goes to all these different places. He has to do all this spy work, which just means going to different places, I guess, traveling the world and being a vacation right. well, and, slideshow.
And it also makes it seem like nobody but James Bond could do it. That's what I think, is that when you go through all these fucking hoops to get to Dr. No,
mm-hmm.
it becomes more and more apparent that if you were there, at some point you would just be like, I don't know how to find him.
Right.
But, yeah. You know, because he's a good conversationalist and he's highly aware of, you know, different clues when people are speaking, and he's able to, you know, pick up on people before, you know, they're able to put up their defenses.
Yeah.
He ends up in, I feel like 50% of the time he ends up in the right place at the right time.
Mm.
And 50% of the time he puts himself in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
But 100% of the time it's only because he's James Bond and nobody else could pull it off. And the fact that it takes so long to get to Dr. No, to me just feels like, man, this is a lot of work to get to Dr. No.
Sure. Sure.
Good thing they got James Bond doing this.
Right. Someone else might just give up or run out of frequent flyer miles.
Whereas
or...
if you look at it the other way, if you look at it from the Jack Ryan perspective, that's a guy going, nah, nah. And then somebody goes, get on the fucking helicopter and go find Dr. No.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm good, man. I don't want it. And they're like, get on the helicopter. And they drop him off.
I believe the line is, I should have submitted a memo. Wasn't that right. written a memo?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, different people play James Bond differently, and different movies will use different parts of his character more or less depending on the time or whether or not it's actually an Ian Fleming novel.
Mm-hmm.
Later, they kind of deviate or just stop using the titles and go these different places. But these are all based similarly to Jack Ryan on novels by a single author.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the actors too. And that's another part of what we want to consider along the journey. So Sean Connery plays, I mean, he's starting off James Bond. And I actually, you know, there's always this question that comes up when people talk about these movies of, you know, who is your favorite Bond or whatever. And I don't want to sound like I am a huge Bond geek, because I'm totally not. But that's a really interesting thing about this franchise, is once you know just a tiny bit, suddenly everybody's having these conversations you would normally have at a Star Wars convention, right?
Right.
I mean, the conversation of who's your favorite Bond or what's your favorite era or whatever, you know, what Bond did you grow up with? These are serious geek out type conversations that casual Bond viewers have, which is just kind of a weird thing about this franchise. It's such an anomaly. There's almost nothing like it. Certainly for 23 films, there's fucking nothing like it.
Right. Yeah.
But usually the diehards are the ones getting, you know, involved in this debate. And the Bond films have very broad appeal. So lots of people see them and, you know, almost nobody sees every single one of them. It was a crazy thing just to sit down, and it was like when we started the show or something that I did that.
Right.
But just sit down and buzz through them all. It's just a crazy endeavor. So Sean Connery's Bond is a very, you know, he's a cool, he's a very collected character. And I like the way they play up the detective work in that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can look at that again, more or less as we go through these other ones. It's so hard to have a lot of the conversation now before seeing other takes on it. And then, you know, we do that same thing, right? We get data and then we start to go, oh, this is a Bond thing because it happened in two movies. It happened in three movies. Right. Oh, this must not be a Bond thing. But those are conversations for another time, I think.
Yeah.
In the meantime, the website is doublefeature.fm. The email address is doublefeatureshow@icloud.com.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't committed the producers to memory, so I'm going to read them off this little thing here, this double feature teleprompter.
All right, please do. Please do, yeah.
This is Brianna Kruger, Rod Fielder, Seth Hanasek, Enrique, David Koch, and Leah Napolitano. I have a pronunciation guide for David's name, and it never helps me. Never helps me at all. you want to set up just a little bit what these movies are for next time?
Yeah, next time we're doing kind of a two guys try to change their life situation double feature. The first film we're going to cover is called Papillon. It's not spelled that way, but that's how you pronounce it. And it stars Steve McQueen and this guy named Dustin Hoffman. Are you familiar with an actor named Dustin Hoffman?
Yes, I have. I have seen him in films before.
Okay, because he's going to be showing up about 20 other times this year.
That's fine.
It's kind of a POW movie, and it's about, you know, how hard it is to have friends in prisoners of war and what money can do for you when you're in an international prison. I don't know why Steve McQueen gets locked up so much, but I enjoy watching Steve McQueen locked up.
John McTiernan is canceling his subscription to our show right now.
And then we're pairing that with Night at the Golden Eagle, featuring double feature friend Adam Rifkin. I guess it doesn't feature him, but he did write and direct it.
I think he's in the background of something. I don't know. We'll check it out next time.
And that's about, it's about a post-prison lifestyle choice that these two aging ex-cons both hatch the last night of them being criminals. Mm-hmm.
And what's really reminiscent of the house from that movie, Mulberry Street.
Without spoiling too much, it's a 24-hour movie. It's called Night at the Golden Eagle, obviously, and it's about two men who are trying to clean up, and their last night is criminals. Mm-hmm.
Well, and as I always have to say, I think the show is a lot better when you've seen the two movies. So. Strongly encouraged.
I guess I have to say, watch more fucking film.
All right, bye.
This program is a proud member of the battleship Pretension Fleet.